Love and Beauty in St. John of the Cross with Father Matthew Blake. Talk 3.
I'm sort of picking up really from what I was speaking about at Mass and this theme of beauty, as we've seen the title of this retreat, Love and Beauty. In particular, John's spiritual canticle, but indeed right throughout his writings, that beauty is there everywhere. We're saying particular in the canticle. The canticle is really it's the whole of life's journey, or the whole spiritual journey, as a journey of change and transformation in love and beauty, transformed in both. Love and beauty. That is what we're transformed into. And I just want to start with sort of a basic principle of John. We find it in his commentary in stanza 5 of the Canticle, where there he speaks first, is very much the artist. John, of course, an artist, and it's very much the artist speaking. When God created everything that he created, as a great artist does, the artist puts something of himself into everything that he has created. There's something of God in everything that's created. Then John goes on then to show that there's another stage to that, and that is God himself becoming part of his creation with the incarnation, which is a further step in creation. I'll just read one line here. And so he's speaking about this lifting up, this elevation of all things, he said, through the incarnation of his Son and through the glory of his resurrection. So not only did the Father beautify creatures partially, but we can say he clothed them entirely in beauty and dignity. So everything, not just people, but the whole of nature, the whole, everything that God created is now clothed in beauty and dignity because God himself has become one with us, has become part of us through the incarnation, through living and dying and rising from the dead. So everything now is clothed in beauty and dignity. And so he's presenting the spiritual journey here now as the person comes to some awareness of this and grows in that awareness. I'll just continue on here where he sort of personalizes this. This is his introduction to stanza 6, where he shows us how the personal implications of this in our lives. He said, from the point of view of contemplative experience, it should be known that in the living contemplation and knowledge of creatures, the soul sees such fullness of graces, powers, and beauty which God has endowed them, that seemingly all are arrayed in wonderful beauty and natural virtue. So the grace of God enables to see this beauty and virtue in everything. That speaks of God. But that's only the starting point. He said the soul, the person, now wounded with love through this trace of the beauty of her beloved, which she has known through creatures, and anxious to see the invisible beauty that caused the visible beauty. For John, the visible beauty always takes one towards the invisible beauty. The beauty of God that is seen in life, in creation, in human experience, in all sorts of different ways that we experience it, is not something that we should stop at or stay with, but rather it lifts our minds and our hearts to the invisible beauty. the beauty that cannot be seen in this world. That's the author of this beauty, the source of this beauty. Of course, is God. In terms of the canticle, as we saw at Mass, it's the Beloved, the Bridegroom, Jesus Christ. And so, when we come to stanza 36, where we're now sort of in the final stages of this process of growth and transformation, and now the person and the Beloved, bride and bridegroom, are so united, and we saw they're united in joy, a shared joy, a joy that they're brought into. And they see each other and everything through the beauty of God. Now it's no longer the visible beauty that can be seen in all around, can be seen in human life. The bride is now united with the invisible beauty, sees through that. Not yet in eternal life, obviously, but still in this life, seen through faith. She sees through now the beauty of God, and she's brought into this. And so the person now transformed in love and in beauty exercises love, he said, in all sorts of different ways, actively, inwardly, outwardly, in every way. And then this beauty, there's this lovely paragraph here, which I'll read as paragraph number 5, this famous graph on beauty, but it just captures so well for us what John is saying. And it's a prayer. He turns away from his readers here. He turns straight to God, addresses God, addresses the bridegroom. So that I be so transformed in your beauty that we may be alike in beauty and both behold ourselves in your beauty, possessing then your very beauty, that in such a way that each looking at the other may see in the other their own beauty, since both are your beauty alone. I being absorbed in your beauty, hence I shall see you in your beauty, and you will see me in your beauty, and I shall see myself in you in your beauty, and you will see yourself in me in your beauty, that I may resemble you in your beauty, and you resemble me in your beauty, that my beauty be your beauty, and your beauty my beauty. Wherefore I shall be in your beauty, and you will be me in your beauty, because your very beauty will be my beauty, and thus we shall behold each other in your beauty. Now, what a sentence. According to the footnote, 23 times the word beauty is used in one sentence. It's perfectly logically worked out if you look at this carefully. And it is always the Beloved's beauty, God's beauty, never the person's beauty, or never the beauty of creatures or creation. It's always God's beauty. And the person is transformed into God's beauty. And the person sees everything through God's beauty. So now everything is seen through the beauty of God. Everything, in other words, is seen as God sees, not as people do, not as this world sees things. We're talking about a whole new way of seeing things. That's what John is showing us here. And where do we go from there then? We go from there, I'll just read a little sentence here. The soul, then, when John means the soul, he means the whole person, the whole. The person, then, cannot see herself in the beauty of God unless she is transformed into the wisdom of God, in which she sees herself in possession of earthly and heavenly things. So it's the wisdom of God. We've seen that with Solomon praying for the wisdom of God last night, this greatest gift that God can give to a person. This is the wisdom of, she sees herself now in that wisdom and sees everything through this wisdom of God. To be transformed in the beauty of God is to be transformed in the wisdom of God. The soul, then, he said, always possesses this desire to have clear and pure understanding of the divine truths. That's there from the very beginning. John shows us this at the very beginning of our kind. We're born with that. We're created with that desire for God, for what John calls the essence of God, for God in himself, not for things about God or signs of God, but for God. We're created with that. Often so many other things camouflage that, hide it, but there, in that deepest place within, there is always that desire for God and nothing less than we're created with that. That's something that is there at the deepest place within. We're made, not only made by God, we're made in the image and likeness of God. We're made for relationship with God. And the desire for that is the deepest desire in every human being. And that's what John is exploring here. Now, what might the fulfillment of that desire in this world look like? Clearly, it cannot be fully fulfilled until the next life. The limits of this life and this world make that impossible. But one can come very close to it through faith, through the full flowering of faith. And that's what he's speaking about here. Now the person transformed in God's beauty and in God's wisdom and is touchy upon something of, has some sense of that fulfillment that the person has always longed for. And now, the greater her love, the more she longs to go further into these truths. That's another principle there in John when it comes to spiritual growth. The more the person grows, the more the person longs to grow. The more the person, we might say, is fulfilled, the more the searching and the longing becomes. Because God gets bigger and bigger. Therefore, the closer one comes to God, the greater that God becomes. And therefore, the greater the desire is. The more it gets fulfilled, the greater it becomes. Because God is bigger and bigger. And so that desire for that pure truth. And so she longs to go further into these. There's no point of arrival. And the way John explains this is that now we're talking about love here. And we're into the depths of love. And love can never come to a point of arrival. He uses the image of fire for love. Love is like a fire. It can always get hotter. It can always go deeper. There is always more riches to be discovered. It never comes to a point of arrival. It is always active. It is always alive and giving out life. And the more that one is living in this love, the deeper one is drawn into this. And so now to be drawn into the depths of this mystery. John uses another image now in this poem, and that is the image of the thickets. That's the woods, the cluster of trees that one is drawn into. I suppose the image is a very useful one because we can imagine a cluster of trees, thick trees. And we can circle all around it. We can even fly over it in a helicopter and get a look at it from a distance. But actually to experience it, one has got to go right in. One has got to struggle to go right into the center, into the dark places within. One has got to touch the ground. One has got to touch the foliage. One has got to go right into it. And that's the image that he uses here. We want to go deeper into this. Knowing about it from a distance or having some kind of distance is not going to satisfy. Person has got to go right in. And so the person longs to enter ever more deeply into this thicket. The thicket of God's wisdom and knowledge. And he's quoting from St. Paul here, which is so deep and so immense that no matter how much the person may know, there's always further to go. There's vast riches, incomprehensible riches to be discovered. This, as I said this morning, is one of the great gifts that John of the Cross's teaching has, and undoubtedly one of the areas of John that John takes us more deeply into. One of the reasons he's a doctor of the church, his exploration of these deep riches, these deep places that God's grace can bring a person into. And so, the more that one is brought into this, the more that one longs to be brought in. The soul ardently wishes to be engulfed in these judgments and know them from further within. See, it's not enough to know something theoretically or know something in some nice image. One wants to know from experience, from the depths within. And so he says, this thicket then, into which the person now, the soul wants to enter, also means the thicket and multitude of trials and tribulations. For suffering is very delightful and beneficial to her. Suffering is the means of penetrating further deep into the thicket of the delectable wisdom of God. The purest suffering brings with it the purest and most intimate knowing, and consequently the purest and highest joy, because it is a knowing from further within. That's not something we can ever understand rationally, but it is the experience of John himself and of so many other people. That joy and that suffering and that wisdom being one, all coming together. Remember what I said a little bit earlier on about being everything being clothed in dignity and beauty. That's what the Son of God did by being born and living and dying and rising from the dead. And that includes suffering. That includes the cross. How do you clothe the cross in beauty and dignity? How do you clothe human suffering in beauty and dignity? We can't. It's something so totally beyond our understanding. Yet, John is saying to us here that that truth is something that can be experienced in faith while we're still in this world, when a person has been so transformed into this beauty and sees everything now, as we've seen already, through the beauty of God. Everything is seen as God sees it. not as this world does or as we do, but as God does. God sees something different. And it is possible for us, with God's grace through God's gift, to see something of how God sees things. The cross through God's eyes looks something very different to what it is through our eyes. Let's go on a little bit. Let's develop this a little bit. So this knowing from further within, that's the kind of knowing. When I was speaking this morning about a doctor of the church and the three sort of criterion or characteristics of the doctor of the church, holiness and doctrine, the relationship between the holiness and the teaching of the person, that a doctor of the church is one who knows from within. They're not just academics. They're not just people who are able to explain the church's teaching in some wonderfully rational and beautiful way. They have to be people who know it from within, know it from experience, know it from the light that comes from within. To know it, to put it in John the Cross's words here, through the prism of God's beauty and God's wisdom and God's love and God's joy. I mentioned that Mass when we were speaking about the poem, that shared joy, that unity of joy, which is the beginning of this stanza. Jesus speaks about this at the Last Supper in John's Gospel, in that Last Supper discourse before he died, that my joy may be complete, he said. He speaks about the cross as the completion of his joy. It passes over our heads. We don't know what it means. But John the Cross is picking up here something of what that means. Okay, just to help us perhaps to clarify this a little bit, I'll just read the next paragraph here, the last paragraph of stanza 36. Oh, he said, if we could but fully understand how a soul cannot reach the thicket and wisdom of the riches of God, which are many kinds, without entering the thicket of many kinds of suffering, finding in this her delight and consolation. And how a soul with an authentic desire for divine wisdom wants suffering first in order to enter this wisdom by the thicket of the cross. That's the entry into this wisdom. Remembering now, of course, that is the life of Jesus, the life of the beloved, the bridegroom of the canticle, and the bride will want to be wherever the bridegroom is. They are now so united, they have become one. But then he goes on to say, quote St. Paul and the letter to the Ephesians. John says, Paul admonishes the Ephesians not to grow weak in their tribulations, but to be strong and rooted in charity, in order to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and the height and the depth, and to know the supereminent charity of the knowledge of Christ, in order to be filled with the utter fullness of God. That's wonderful prayer of Ephesians and the end of chapter 3 of Ephesians. The gate of entering into these riches is his wisdom, of his wisdom is the cross, which is narrow. And few desire to enter by it, but many desire the delights obtained from entering there. In fact, as we've seen, everybody desires. John has already shown us this earlier on in the canticle. Everybody desires. But few are able to choose it, are able to make this choice to enter by this narrow gate. We're put off by it. We find it off-putting. And yet, the very thing that we find most off-putting. It is there that the most profound wisdom of God is. That's a principle running through John of the Cross's teaching, that whatever it is in the teachings of Jesus or in the life of Jesus that we find most off-putting, that's the place to turn to, because there is something profound being revealed by God. When something is less like the wisdom of this world, then it is more the wisdom of God. John gives the example of chapter 6 of John's Gospel. There in chapter 6 of John's Gospel, at the beginning there's great crowds because there's the multiplication of all the food and they all have a great meal, all this great crowd have, and then Jesus walks on water. But then, as his teaching becomes more profound, less and less people are able to stay. Every stage of his teaching becoming more profound, people walk away. Till in the end, there's only the disciples left. And Jesus asks them, are you going to go away also? The more profound the teaching, the less people are able to stay there. And yet, that's the teaching that leads one into this mystery of who Jesus is. And of course, the same applies to the cross. The same applies to any of the teaching of Jesus. John tells us, for example, in the Ascent of Mount Carmel, book 2, chapter 7, where he says very much on this. He said, when we listen to Jesus, he said, try to listen to the parts of his teaching that we're least drawn to, least attracted to. Some bits we love and we're very attracted to, but there's other parts we're not. Try to focus on them, because there's some profound mystery. We may not understand it. We may never understand it, but we're drawing close to some profound wisdom of God there. Jesus never said anything that was superficial or was not important for us for some reason. The fact that we do not understand it is not a reason not to listen to it, or that we're not attracted to it. That's not a reason not to listen to it. There's some profound mystery there. So, as you can see, John of the Cross is exploring the most profound places a human being can find themselves in this world. The deepest places that our relationship with God can take us. Places that I've already said are beyond the boundaries of what we can know, what we can understand, what we're attracted to, what we might even be hoping for. This is beyond all those boundaries. But it's all there in the life of Jesus Christ. It is all there in the experience of Jesus Christ. And here in John's Canticle, the bride, then the person, is now so united with her beloved, the bridegroom, that she wants to and is sharing everything with him. So what does it mean to live a life at one with Jesus Christ? A life that has truly become Christian. That's what the Canticle is outlining for us.